My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
All right, Bjorn, thanks for joining me today. I'm super excited to dig into this conversation.
Hey, it's great to be here, Mark.
So, boy, you have written a new book, and it's a very timely book for the situation that the world is in right now, going through an energy crisis, a massive hurricane that just crushed Florida. Two weeks ago, there was a massive earthquake that hit Mexico City. I happened to be down there on the 35th floor, swinging back and forth. Wow. And it's all because of climate change, apparently. Now, you've written a new book, and the title is False Alarm, How Climate Change Panics is Costing Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. So the title of the book, False Alarm, is like, oh, all this climate alarmism you're stating is a false alarm. And then you kind of, with the subtitle, is like, how the panic's costing us a lot of money, it hurts the poor, right? I get those things. So you're stating that this climate alarmism is a false alarm.
So I'm saying that we're overly worried about climate change. Yes, it's a real problem. It's something that we should fix. But the way that almost everyone now thinks it's the end of the world or near the end of the world. So a new survey of OECD countries, so the rich world essentially, showed that 60% of all people in the OECD now believes that climate change will very likely or likely lead to the end of mankind. And that's just simply bonkers. That's not what the UN climate panel is telling us. They're telling us this is a problem. Without global warming, we'd be better off. But it's not like we're headed for extinction or anything. And because people are overworried, it both makes, you know, most kids are scared witless about climate change. Of course, that's terrible in so many different ways if they're vastly overworried, but it also means that all the adults just spend money in the wrong places. You know, if you're worried, you're just going to throw out all your money on this one problem. And that's not the way either to fix climate change or all the other problems in the world.
Hmm. That's an alarming number. 60% of people are worried about that. Was there any data in that study that shows like over what time frame? Because it seems like most of the IPCC data that comes out, it's like in the next 100 years. Like, are they think this is going to happen like in their lifetime? I mean, that's what Greta Thunberg's telling them, right?
That's hard to tell given, you know, they didn't specify, do you think you're going to die in the 2040s or 2050s? It's more, and honestly, you know, also if you look at what people say, they'll tell you, yes, I actually think this is going to lead to the extinction of the human race. So what are you going to do this summer? And they'll go, oh, I'm flying to Mallorca. You know, that we have radically different ways that we actually live our lives. And then on the other hand, we're really worried about this. So I think it's more sort of a cultural phenomena that you feel guilty, that you feel like this is a terrible thing, and that you constantly reinforce it with your friends and everybody else saying, yeah, this is going to lead to the extinction of humankind. It's not the actual thing that people are really worried about. You know, I step out tomorrow, I'm going to be dead. But it's more the feeling that this is really the number top one thing that we should be concerned about. And again, that is wrong in so many different ways. And it leads us to do wrong policies that make world less well off.
Like what? What kind of policies are we seeing that are making the world less well off right now?
So one fundamental thing is, if you look at what we're doing for climate change, a lot of it is essentially just greenwashing. It's feeling good about doing something for climate without having much of an impact. So one of the most important things that people talk about is to subsidize electric cars to somehow feel like we're doing something about the climate crisis. But in reality, electric cars, they're a nice little thing. They'll cut a little bit of CO2. And, you know, if you've ever driven a Tesla, they're fun, you know, cars to drive around.
Sure.
But they're just not the thing that's going to solve global warming. First of all, they're incredibly expensive. They actually emit more air pollution, surprisingly, because they're more, they're heavier, and hence they actually, they emit a lot more particulates from tires, from road wear, and from braking. But fundamentally, they're an incredibly expensive way. So we subsidize them to the tune of $5,000 or $10,000, depending on where you are on the planet, for very little CO2 cuts. So that's one part. We're doing it very badly. At the other end, remember what most people, so, you know, 5-6 billion people on this planet live with less than, you know, $30 a day. They live in pretty awful conditions. Their kids are dying from easily curable infectious diseases. They don't get enough education. They don't get enough food. They have all kinds of other problems. And we're saying the most important thing is that I switch my SUV out with a Tesla instead of focusing on getting these kids, I don't know, medication. So my point here is twofold, to say there are many other problems we ought to focus on first. And yes, climate change is also a problem. We're smart species. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. But please, let's do this effectively, and we're not, because we're scared witless.
Yeah, the sense of fear has kind of put us into this panic where we're not thinking through it clearly. On the greenwashing side, obviously we have this whole energy situation going on over in Europe. And I've been talking about on some of my shows how in the United States, it's happening in Europe as well, but in the United States, they're like cutting down all these forests, taking the trees, shipping them over to Europe, putting them into wood chips so they can burn them in the fireplace, and supposedly that's greenwashing. Supposedly that's green. Cutting down the trees that are supposed to be scrubbing the CO2 out of the atmosphere and then burning them. So then, that's what you're talking about, the greenwashing. They're making it seem like they're doing something, but in reality, maybe it's even worse off than if they didn't do that.
Yeah. So the short story is, even if you do it right, it's unlikely that you're actually making much of climate impact. As you point out, you know, when you burn the wood, you're actually emitting more CO2 than if you had burnt coal. Now, the theory is, but you're going to reforest those trees, and over the next, you know, 80 to 120 years, they'll actually soak up all that extra CO2 that you just burnt. But yeah, that's like 80 to 120 years too late. Yeah. And also, of course, they're not actually doing that if they were just doing it really well, but they're also cutting down essentially old growth forest in Canada and elsewhere. So, you know, the fundamental point is, no, this is a terrible way to do it. And again, most people think, when you're talking about green, we think, oh, it's all from solar and wind. Solar makes up 0.8% of global energy. Wind makes up 1% of energy. Most of the renewables that we get is not even solar or wind or even hydro. It's wood. So, you know, it's about 11% of it is wood. both in poor countries where they use it to cook and keep warm, but in rich countries, it's mostly biofuels. We use it to make, in Iowa, they make lots and lots of ethanol. But most places, they just simply grow fast-growing sorts of wood, and then we burn them in our incinerators. It makes us feel green, but the honest answer, as you point out, is it's very little green, and it's incredibly subsidized. Again, bad decisions.
Yeah, wow. I didn't know about that. Now, it seems like we have an emergency because supposedly natural disasters are getting worse and worse and worse. So I've seen we have this huge storm that hit Florida. I saw Financial Times said that hurricane frequency is on the rise. New York Times said strong storms are becoming more common in the Atlantic. Washington Post said climate change is rapidly fueling super hurricanes. ABC News says how climate change intensifies hurricanes and on and on and on. In California, where I'm at, we've been having big fires, and supposedly the fires are because of climate change as well. They have no problem sensationalizing this to climate change. What does the data say about that?
So, it is a very controversial conversation to talk about this because it's very easy to make you feel like, oh my God, there are more and more crises. But most of this is really just the, if you will, the CNN effect, that we see more and more stuff that's really terrible on the news. If you remember back to from the late 1980s, there was more and more talk shows in the U.S. There were more and more news, and everybody actually thought crime was getting worse and worse. While the statistic was showing, crime was getting less and less. Now, maybe it's turned around the last couple of years, but the fundamental point remains, just because you see a lot of stuff on TV doesn't actually mean that there is more of it in reality. And so if you look at the numbers, so lots of people have looked at, for instance, how many hurricanes actually hit the U.S. This is important because they're likely to be counted even in old times. Remember, hurricanes out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean that nobody saw. We see them today with satellites, but we didn't see them 50 or 100 years ago because there didn't happen to be a ship there at the time. So landfalling hurricanes is one great way of showing this. And they actually show a slight decline, not an increase, both in the number and in the number of strong hurricanes. So that's very counter to what most of those headlines you just mentioned. Yeah. If you look at the number of total hurricanes, they've also tried to estimate that, making up for the fact that there weren't ships back in times of old. And they also find you cannot see an increase. The only increase you see, and the one that, for instance, Financial Times showed, was simply an increase in observed storms, because we have better technology. So most of this is simply hype. This does not mean that there isn't a problem. So we estimate that because of global warming, we will see slightly fewer, but slightly stronger hurricanes. Now, stronger is worse than fewer, so it actually turns out that hurricanes will get a little worse. But we cannot tell right now. So NOAA and everybody else is telling us we can't tell right now. It's only the newspapers that apparently have this ability, not the scientists, but the newspapers to tell us, oh my God, it's all getting stronger and stronger. And one obvious way that you can see this is, do you remember? There were no hurricanes in the Atlantic in all of August. And it was, it's the first time in 25 years it happened. Almost nobody wrote about it. Then there's one huge hurricane that hits Florida and everybody says, see, global warming. That's not a good way to get ourselves informed. Now, a much, much stronger impact knowledge is we know that these catastrophes impact humans much, much less. So if you look at the number of dead, not just from storms, but from all the kind of climate impacts that you have, so storms, wildfires, extreme temperatures, droughts, and floods, we've seen a dramatic decline over the last 100 years. In the 1920s, on average, about 500,000 people died from these climate-related disasters. Last year, the number was less than 7,000. We've seen a dramatic decline of more than 99%. This is not predominantly anything to do with climate, but just simply the fact that as humankind get richer, we get much more resilient. You live in Florida, yes, hurricanes hit you and some people will die. But if the same hurricane had hit Guatemala, tens of thousands of people would have died and it would have eradicated their economy. So getting people out of poverty is a really, really great strategy to make sure that people are not hurt. And that's also what we see in the total impact on GDP. So globally, since the 1990s, we have good global data. These climate-related disasters typically used to cost about 0.25% of GDP. Now it's down to about 0.18%. That tells you two things. It's not increasing, as most people would like you to believe. It's actually decreasing. And secondly, of course, it's a pretty small number. It's not nothing. And if you lived through this hurricane in Florida, it was terrible, of course. Yeah. But the fundamental point is, this is not the thing that will drive us to extinction. This is not the end of humankind. If anything, we're getting slightly better at dealing with these hurricanes and all the other things. However, if we had had no climate change, we would be becoming even better at it. So climate change makes us slightly less better over the, into the future. That's a very different sort of message than the one that you typically hear, namely, we're all going to die.
Mm-hmm. My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Now, when I was a kid, probably even before I was a real kid, in the 70s, I think it was global cooling, right? And then it became global warming. I think today it's just climate change is what they talk about, right? And it seems like the temperature is always changing. And I've heard some people say that I think during the Roman Empire, the world was 6 degrees warmer than it is today. So is it something that the climate's always changing, and so we're always having to kind of adapt to that?
Again, I'm a social scientist, so I'm a little sort of skeptical about these grand claims that we know the temperature 2,000 years ago. Yeah. It seems to me, so I've obviously read a lot of the literature. Yes, the temperature has changed quite a bit. And obviously, when you go back to the ice ages that we've had, we had much, much lower temperatures. And I think most people, had there been more civilizations around, would have been stuck in a much, much less welcoming world. So, you know, fundamentally, we have to realize that things keep changing. And it's likely that whatever happens, researchers are going to say, ooh, could that be a problem? We should actually be happy that they do that, because, you know, that's how we avoid problems. Yeah. A lot of the things they worry about turn out not to be worryable. But it's great that there are people doing that for all of them. So, you know, there were people investigating, are we seeing a new global cooling? And they were telling us much of the same things. You know, we'd get less food, and we'd have more catastrophes and all that kind of stuff. And it's probably slightly true, because remember, everyone lives in places that are adapted to what the climate was the last couple hundred years. So if it got colder or warmer, we'd be a little screwed. But it's important to recognize we'd only be a little screwed because we know how to deal with these things. You know, so if you take a comparison with Miami and Boston, obviously they have very different climates and they're pretty well adjusted to where they are. And both of them would be somewhat off if it got colder or warmer. Yeah. But the trick is to realize we know that Boston can handle be much warmer because that's what Miami shows. And likewise, that Miami could get colder and we still know how to do it. It would have a cost, but we've actually made pretty good estimates of how big of a cost this is going to be. And it's a fairly small cost. And as you get richer, it becomes smaller because you become more resilient. So yeah, there is a problem, but let's not get carried away and get too scared.
Yeah. To that point about being resilient, I'm here in Southern California, which is a desert. It gets pretty hot. Next door is Arizona, and we had a house out there on the lake. And in the summertime, it gets to be 125 degrees, which is about 51.5 Celsius. And people are flocking out there. People are flocking out there. It's one of the fastest growing areas. Yep. And it turns out we have air conditioners, and people can move to 125 degrees. It's insane. Let's talk more then about some of the social impacts of this. And so I know one of the big things, you kind of made the case that, you know, it's like in the U.S., our energy secretary is just like, and transportation secretary, like, oh, well, this is really good because people should just go buy electric vehicles. Just go spend $80,000 or $100,000, sure. But, like, we have a massive social impact to the rest of the world that maybe people don't think about in this viewpoint. One of the ways, as I read a lot of this stuff, it seems that one of the ways they're really trying to target this is that if they can impose these carbon taxes on us, then they can really make some change. And it seems like most likely they want to impose this climate tax because then if it costs us a whole bunch more to drive our cars or fly our airplanes or eat our steak, then one, we will do less of that. And two, then I guess they'll have extra money to go find new solutions. But like that's going to severely impact at least half of the world.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of points here. First of all, most climate economists, and I consider myself a tiny bit of that, would tend to say you should tax bads rather than goods, right? So right now, we raise most of the public money that we raise around the world on stuff we actually like. So, you know, work and VAT for you know, stuff you like to buy. That's somewhat inefficient. So if we could tax bads instead, so tax, for instance, pollution, that would not be a bad idea. So the problem, of course, is, and I think
are you saying it's not a bad idea? Or you're saying they're saying it's not a bad idea.
So, well, I'm saying that it's probably not a bad idea in theory. Now, your concern, I think that would be a correct one, is if you give politicians more opportunities to tax, it's not like they're going to reduce your income tax and reduce your VAT and then tax your carbon. They're just going to tax more. That is a real concern, and that's something that politically needs to be talked out. But it would actually be a fairly effective way to tackle climate change by having a moderate carbon tax. So I'm saying that would be a pretty good idea. It's we need to raise money in some way for, you know, for states, for no other reason, for, you know, police and enforcement and military and you know, infrastructure, that kind of thing. So you should try to tax bads rather than goods. But you really need to make sure that politicians don't use this as a spigot. You're also right in saying that a lot of the poor world couldn't afford to do that. If you actually try to make the carbon taxes that people are talking about in the rich world, that would be absolutely devastating in most of the poor world. And moreover, you have to realize that any realistic carbon tax is not the main part of the solution, simply because any realistic carbon tax is not going to change all that much of what we do. You know, if you want to get you to drive a lot less, you need to really tax you a lot. And of course, we already did that in Europe. We have much higher gasoline taxes than you have, and people still drive because it's actually really nice to be able to drive. And so the reality is you can moderate people's behavior a little bit, but it's not really going to be the main part of the solution. And that's why I keep saying, let's not focus too much on this technically correct thing, which is a carbon tax, but let's focus much more on how do you normally solve big issues. You don't solve them by telling people, I'm sorry, you have to do less of the stuff you like. You know, you have to travel less and you have to sweat more and when it's hot and freeze more when it's cold and you have to have fewer burgers and all that kind of stuff. That's not the way to solve this issue. The way you do this is through innovation. Imagine if we could come up with a clean, green energy source that was cheaper than fossil fuels. You would have no problem switching. Nobody would have a problem. The Chinese and the Indians wouldn't have a problem. So the reality here is, if you could innovate cheap green energy, we'd be done. If you could have, say, fusion, and again, fusion is somewhat of the holy grail and also a little right. bit of a myth. But, if we could actually do it, we would have all the energy we'd need, and it would have virtually no cost and certainly no climate impact. That would be a phenomenal solution. So instead of trying to get everybody to do stuff they don't want, try to get people to do stuff that's smart and innovative. If you think back in the 1950s, Los Angeles was a terribly polluted place, mostly because of air pollution from cars. The sort of standard climate alarmist argument applied back then would be to say, I'm sorry, could everyone just park their cars and just walk or run instead? And of course, you'd never actually gotten anywhere with that. But yeah. The reality is you didn't solve it that way. You solved it with a catalytic converter. Somebody innovated this little thing. Yes, it costs a little bit of money. You put it on the tailpipe, and then you can basically drive and almost not pollute. That's how you solve problems, not by telling people you can't, you shouldn't, you mustn't.
Yeah. So I agree. I recently wrote my own book, The Uncommonist Manifesto, and in that book, we really champion capitalism and say that it's not a political modality. This is just the way natural humans work. We innovate. Instead of carrying one rock at a time, I created a wheelbarrow, and now I carry 10 rocks at a time. And so we're always trying to become more efficient with scarce resources. Like, that's our goal. Like, we're always trying to become more efficient. And if we're competing in business, you're trying to become more efficient and use less resources than I do, so you have more profits and so forth. So I get that. There's this natural drive. When you talk about it like this, I mean, are you saying that maybe it would be better to have some sort of a government-led incentive to do that, some sort of like tax incentives to reinvest into research and development, something like that?
So I don't think it's tax. I think it's more a subsidy for basically just grants to academic organizations to come up with the next big thing. Remember, and let me just walk you through this. So in economics, they would tend to say there is a persistent underinvestment in big social beneficial innovation. So take, for instance, medical care. You have Pfizer and all these other companies. They'll make great products once they're pretty close to marketability. But you don't make these big Nobel laureate breakthroughs that'll, 40 years down the line, create lots of profit. Why? Because by then your patent has run out. So there's a substantial underinvestment in long-term stuff simply because you can't privatize most of the benefit. Most of the benefit is just going to be social for everyone. And that's why
Push back on that. Let me push back on that for a minute. I would say the opposite. I believe all innovation comes from private markets, not from the government. And the reason, and I can also point to a good example. So the United States has cut its emission by 30% over the last decade.
Yeah.
How has it been able to do that? By mainly innovations that happened with fracking that moved us to natural gas that lowered the emissions. That was brought on by the private market, right? The government didn't invent that. As a matter of fact, the government doesn't invent anything. And so we see the government, like under Obama, give $500 million to what, Solana for solar panels, and it all just went to Legresse and to fraud, right? So, you know, maybe some sort of incentivizing private corporations to do things if you need it, but the carbon emissions were cut the biggest that we've ever seen because of private markets created that.
So I'll challenge you on that.
Yeah, please. Let's discuss it.
First of all, absolutely, we should not be spending $500 billion on, wasn't it Solyndra it was called?
Solyndra, you're right.
But there's a lot of ways to spend money badly from government. But actually, the Breakthrough Institute has actually made a history of how did we spend on fracking. And I also met with Mitchell, the billionaire. He's dead now, who championed much of fracking in Texas for the first 10 years. And basically what they did was they said, we think this might work, but we can't get anyone to invest in it. And so DARPA and many others and DOE actually spent about $10 billion in total from the federal government on helping these pioneers figuring out how do you do this so that it eventually becomes cost beneficial. That turned out to be an incredibly good investment, but nobody at the time was really willing to do this in the private companies. So there is an argument for saying that George Bush started this in the early 2000s, obviously not because he cared about the climate change, but because he wanted to have the U.S. have more gas and oil, hopefully also, so that they'd be more, you guys would be more self-sufficient. But the fundamental point was a little bit of money spent smartly was actually a great way to get everybody to innovate this technology that has now caused the U.S. to cut its carbon emissions more than any other nation over the last 10 years. Absolutely, that's how you do it. But the point here is that you need some innovation that is not personally profitable, because the innovation of impact will be too far into the future. That's why there's an underinvestment. That's why we spend a lot of money publicly, through National Research Foundation, many others, in the health space. But likewise, we're spending way too little on energy. And again, if we could, for instance, almost all fusion energy is funded by the government. I'm not arguing whether that's a good or a bad idea, but that's fundamentally because all private companies think it's a little bit too far away for me to actually believe this is going to happen. But imagine if it did. We all of humanity would be better off. A second part is, of course, if you did this in the U.S., you could probably sell it to the rest of the free world, but you'd have a hard time selling it to India or to Ethiopia or something. But they would actually also have a huge benefit. So there's just a humanitarian benefit from doing these things. So I'm saying we should be spending money specifically on innovation. And this is mostly research.
As opposed to, because all the governments are spending tons of money on windmills and solar panels,
yes.
But that's old technology that us to where we need. So we need innovation to find a new solution.
Exactly. Don't spend money on stuff we already know doesn't work. Spend money on making new stuff that may work in 10, 20, 30 years. That's the kind of thing that'll make the breakthrough. So, Craig Venter, the guy who cracked the human genome back in 2000, he has this idea, and it's a slightly crazy idea, right? He has this idea that he wants to grow algae out on the ocean surface, genetically modified algae, that basically takes sunlight and CO2 and produce oil. Then we harvest that whole thing out there every couple of months and bring it in and keep our entire fossil fuel infrastructure and run on oil that's now CO2 free because we just soaked up the CO2 out in the ocean surface, right? So we could basically all grow our own Saudi Arabia out on the ocean surface and keep our entire infrastructure. Now, it doesn't work right now, which of course is why we haven't changed the whole infrastructure. But the point is, if we give him some research money, and there is already some that are somewhat funding him, but we should definitely give him a couple $1 million so that he can run his research project and perhaps come up with the idea that's going to power humanity for the next many centuries. How cool would that be? And the point is, there are many of these ideas out there. They're incredibly cheap, and we only need one of them to become true.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, Oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit nfl.com/schedule-release to learn more.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Yeah. Now, we are spending, I know you had talked about like, what is global warming going to cost us? I know like in the COP26 meeting they had last year, right? They came out with like a price tag of what, $150 trillion they wanted to spend over the next, whatever, 30 years. And I think that was mostly to transition us into this wind and solar. Now you said that renewables don't work. Why would we spend that money, trillions of dollars, into stuff we already know doesn't work?
Or at least works a lot less effectively, which of course means that most people are not actually going to do it. The simple point is, what are you going to do when the sun is not shining and the wind is not blowing? People kind of blow off this question, but that is the fundamental problem. Now, you can have solar, and it actually makes sense to have solar in California because you use a lot of air conditioning in the middle of the day when solar panels make a lot of energy. And so we kind of know, and you know, you really don't need air conditioning nearly as much if the sun is not shining, you know, if it's a cloudy day. So it actually makes sense to have some solar that actually just, you know, power your air conditioning in the middle of the day. But when you move beyond that, you're basically just setting yourself up for failure. You're saying, all right, so we get a lot of our solar, a little bit more than the middle of the day. But then right when the sun goes down, we need to ramp up everything and have lots and lots of standby power. And that basically just means you have to buy your whole energy system twice. Both have the solar panels and then have the gas peakers back up. And that means your energy becomes much more expensive and you haven't solved very much of the problem. The way to do that, you know, people will then say, oh, what about batteries? Right now, batteries can supply the entire world, global energy, electricity production for 1 minute and 14 seconds. So no, you know, once that happens, you're basically back to relying on fossil fuels. And this is not going to change anytime soon. So the point here is we need to find something that actually gives baseload power, which could be nuclear, could be fusion. It could be, you know, Craig Venter's idea. There's a lot of different ways it could be, but it's very unlikely that it's going to be solar with lots and lots and lots and lots of batteries.
Yeah. Well, and then you have to look at the cost benefit analysis. Yes. So then what does that look like to get enough minerals to build all those batteries? What is the what is the carbon output to even do that? What does the world look like after you've dug up half the world and had to process all those metals and, you know, ship them all over the world? I mean, what does that do? So but let's, do you look at this as a net, like the world is all together, like we're one world, or is it like region by region? And the reason why I ask that is, like, should we be trying to get we could probably when you're trying to improve things, the beginning part of the improvement's the easy part. It's the last mile that's the hardest, right? So, like, it would make sense if we look at the world as a net that we could really make massive gains in the third world, the emerging markets, where trying to get more gain in the United States is going to be harder. We've already cut 30%. But it seems like the U.S. has this policy, and other, obviously Europe it does as well, where it's like, you know, the U.K. or Germany, we're not going to get our natural gas out of the ground because climate change, but that's okay if Russia does, and we'll just buy it from Russia. How do you see that? Is it regional or is it global? Because that's, to me, it seems like it should be global.
Yeah. The world is obviously regional or even just national. And there's a lot of stuff that we do that's very, very stupid. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, it's a good idea. And most sort of analysts would tend to try and say, let's first look at it from a global level. And yet you're absolutely right. We should try to get India and China and many others to cut their carbon emissions because it's much, much cheaper to do there than in the US or in Europe. But it turns out to be really hard because they actually have other priorities. You know, if you're poor, that's your basic objective, you know, get people out of poverty and make sure that you get a better life. And it's hard to disagree with, you know, if we're sitting here in a comfortable Western world. Yeah, you can't really say, sure, they shouldn't become rich, which I think a lot of Greens are. They're not saying that outright. And of course, if you actually put it in their face, they would say, no, of course they should become rich. But the actual impact of the policies that they're pushing are essentially to keep them much less rich or even in poverty.
I mean, John Kerry said as much. he told us that, right?
We're just not going to manage to get them on board for doing that. But the reality is we need to talk about how much is it going to cost to cut carbon emissions and how much benefit is it going to do. And first of all, I think I just want to show you one very basic thing, which is, you know, there's a lot of economists who've been working on what is actually the cost of climate change. And one of them, William Nordhaus from Yale University, got the Nobel Prize in 2018. He's the only climate economist to get the Nobel Prize. What he found was that if we do nothing about climate, the impact by the end of the century is equivalent to the world being about 4% less well off than we would otherwise have been. It's important to say, you know, 4% is not the end of humanity, but it's not nothing. But just to give you a sense of proportion, the UN climate panel estimates that by the end of the century, each person on the planet will be about 450% as rich as he or she is today. That's an amazing achievement, right? We'll be much, much better off by the end of the century. Climate change means that instead of being 450% as rich, it'll feel like we're only 434% as rich.
Oh, no.
Now, that's a problem. You know, I'd rather be 450% as rich, but it's not the end of the world. The world will be fantastically much better, but because of global warming, slightly less fantastically much better. That's a very different framework than the one that we typically, the world is going to be a hellscape and we're all just going to be dead and, you know, fire is going to be everywhere and drought and all the stuff that you don't like. And of course, there's going to be lots of Hurricane Ians and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's just not the reality of this.
Yeah. Well, and it's certainly better than living back under freezing cold conditions with candles like they're about to in Europe at some point, maybe this year. But back to kind of the point that I was talking about. So Germany doesn't want to get their natural gas out of the ground because, you know, climate. But if Russia does, that's fine. And we'll just get it from Russia. No big deal. But that affects the global climate change. So why not just Germany just get out of the ground? It's the same thing, right? I mean, I guess it makes them feel good. But back to the point that I was trying to get to is investing money in what we know works. And so we know that as we use more energy-dense materials, so if we go from wood to coal, that's better, from coal to natural gas, oil, natural gas, et cetera, right? We get better, better, better. So to your point, India, China, and other nations that are trying to bring their people out of poverty, as they should, in my opinion. I mean, it's apocalyptic for people today that have no energy. And so we should, but the U.S. could just increase its natural gas output as Europe, as the UK, as Germany, as Europe could. We could increase natural gas output and we could get that to those countries or help them get it or help them get nuclear, which would drastically bring that down. We know it works. They would, of course, love to have cheap, abundant energy, which is what they want, and we could have a massive impact, seems. But maybe that's too common sense.
Oh, I'm sure common sense is a problem here. But I think it's more a question of realizing that, you know, most of these countries are not stupid. They know what actually works, which of course is why they still build lots of coal-fired power. Because, you know, in many of these areas, coal is still the cheapest. Now, it has, you know, some terrible consequences. Actually, it makes a lot of air pollution, which is the main problem with coal. It really kills, you know, more than 500,000 people every year. So it's something that we should be concerned about. And certainly, as you get richer, you'll probably stop using coal as much and start switching to gas. The point that we can help with, I think, is simply to make sure that the cleaner choices are available as soon as these countries have gotten out of poverty and are now starting to say, just like we are, I'd like a cleaner environment. Yeah. So the reality here is, yes, we should try to go for cheaper nuclear. Remember, current generation nuclear, so third generation nuclear, is quite expensive, especially in the first world, so in the rich world. They constantly run over when you build them, and they generate some of the most expensive electricity. It would be wonderful if they didn't, but that's not where we are. Now, fourth generation nuclear, like the thing that, for instance, Bill Gates and many others are pushing for and investing in, could potentially make green energy, so, you know, no CO2 energy, incredibly cheap and incredibly safe. I'm excited about that. And I would certainly love that. But I don't know. So if we can get fourth generation nuclear to be cheaper than fossil fuels and safe, you know, obviously this is the kind of technology that people are going to go for everywhere on the planet, both in rich countries, but also in poor countries. And we should be focusing on a lot of these different technologies, because we don't know if it's going to be fourth generation nuclear. We should be funding all of these technologies. And again, remember, funding all of them with cheap researchers would still be much, much cheaper than what we're currently spending just in subsidizing ineffective solar and wind.
And I think, I mean, we have to keep kind of coming back to that point, to the point that you made, which I would agree with. Like, we already know these technologies don't work. Why would we continue to go down this path until we find something that does work and then we want to invest that money? But the thread that I kept trying to pull on was, if we're really trying to bring down the climate, you know, fix the climate for the world, as opposed to, well, look how good the U.S. is and the rest of the world sucks, but like at least we're good here. But like it affects us all because we're all in the same world. So again, it seems like we could probably even, again, use some of this money to maybe help them get their emissions up a little bit, as opposed to trying to continue to do things that don't work. You had said in your book you had a section called why the Paris Agreement is failing. And obviously the Paris Agreement is this agreement that gets the world coordinated to all bring down their emissions together, supposedly, right? I did a video on the climate, on the Paris Accord at one point, not on the science, just on the actual agreement itself. And basically each nation just commits to what they're going to do, right? But again, it's trying to get this world coordinated to come down, and we know we can get these other nations to come down. India agreed, committed, and you can correct me if I'm wrong if it's changed, but they had committed to not increase their emissions as a percentage of their GDP, I think. So as long as their GDP keeps going up.
But by 2030, as I remember, which is not actually constraining them at all.
There's no constraint. And then China agreed to increase their CO2 until 2030. And then, of course, maybe, you know, hopefully they promise that they'll bring it down. Why do you say that it's failing, the Paris Accord?
Well, fundamentally, because most countries, when it comes down, you know, when the rubber hits the road, they're not willing to spend a lot of money to be worse off and not actually contribute to cut carbon emissions very much. This is not rocket science. And so... we've all gotten together and promised we're going to do stuff that's hard, that's politically inconvenient, and that will have fairly little impact. Remember, even if we all did the Paris Agreement, the impact would almost be unmeasurable by the end of the century. We need to cut much, much more if we're actually going to make a difference. And of course, that's why this is such a hard problem. And that's, again, why I'm saying, instead of trying to make this about, you know what? We promised all these hard things in Paris, but it's not enough, so we have to do even harder things. That's never going to sell tickets. Instead, you know, focus on innovation. So Paris Agreement is failing fundamentally because it has fairly little benefits and it has huge costs. And the benefits are distributed around the world, but the costs are to each individual nation. That's a very hard thing to live up to. And that's, of course, why everyone goes to all these meetings, make lots of promises, get all the applause, and then go home and don't do it.
This is reaching a little bit here, but do you think there's ulterior motives in the climate agenda? So forcing us to spend all this money into technology we know doesn't work, wind and solar. All the wind and solar comes from China, using a carbon-based credit system to control movement and what we eat, things like that. Do you think there's some ulterior motive there? Because it seems, again, common sense would say, shoot, we know these things don't work. Why would you spend $100 trillion? We could make a bigger impact on the world by just doing a few things that we already know works. It seems so simple to me.
Yeah. So I mean, the short answer is, when I've met with all these guys, my understanding is that they really strongly feel that this is a big problem, and because they're worried about climate change. But of course, everyone else latches on to this. So, when we had the big climate conference in Copenhagen, not surprisingly, the world's biggest wind turbine producer, which happens to be Danish, had all the metro stations plastered with advertisements say, make a strong deal, which incidentally will also make us rich. Yeah, it's not surprising that everybody sort of slots in there and try to see if they can make money. And I'm pretty sure that, Russia and China and many others would love to see the West encumbering their economies with more costs while they're not doing it. So obviously there's a lot of sort of co-benefits from a lot of other players. But my sense is that when you have this kind of conversation, it's more helpful to actually take people on their statements. And certainly most people in the rich world do want to do climate because they're really worried about climate. And so I try to say, look, yes, I get you're worried. You're probably over worried because you've heard a lot of these statements that you started off with that are not actually and factually correct. It is a problem, but a much smaller one than you think. And also that you haven't heard that most of the policies that are being proposed are actually incredibly expensive ways to do very little. If that's true, why don't we try to get you here and then say, shouldn't we do smarter stuff? And that's what we've been talking about, investing, for instance, in innovation that'll actually come up with great solutions.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, and to the point that you've made, I mean, and the point of the book, right, the alarmism is a little bit misguided. The stat that you said that we'll be 4% less well off at the end of the century. I mean, it's we don't want to be less well off. Let's be as better well off as we can be. But this is at the end of the century, right? This is a long time, and so we have time to find a better solution, and then we can go in on that new solution when we find it. Again, it just seems so common sense.
Yeah. If you think about, do you remember the CFLs, the compact fluorescent light bulbs? Certainly Europe, I'm not sure whether the U.S. forced everyone to stop using incandescent light bulbs. You need to switch to these CFL.
LED bulbs,
these I think really they inconvenient
are. Yeah, here, LED yes. bulbs.
Are, sorry?
LED?
Yeah, they're... No. It was before LED. So, like, in the early 2000s, everyone was forced to switch to these very... They're pretty large, and they needed, like, a second to fire up, and you couldn't really dim them and all this stuff. They were inconvenient. People hated the light and everything. Certainly in Europe, and also many other places, we basically forced people to switch because, you'll save some energy, and then you'll save climate. Turned out that LED lamps came around just, a few short years later. And they were much better. They were much cheaper. They saved much more energy. And everyone would want them. Now, because you'd force people to do the bad switch, now a lot of people are already, because they were expensive, they wouldn't want to then change over again to another expensive LED. So we actually ended up, because we wanted to do so much good, we actually ended up cutting less than we otherwise would have had we just waited for the really smart solution. So that's in a small encapsulate of what you're basically saying. Let's not do the dumb stuff now. Let's make sure it's smart and then switch over.
No, I agree.
From BBC Radio 4. Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
So I'm all about market innovation. It's the forced changes that I have a problem with, which is where when you start getting government involved a little bit, and these kind of forced changes can be sticky, but that's not the point that you're making. And then I guess finally you talk about how to actually fix climate change. So you don't just sit there and talk about problems, nor do you deny it. You're just realistic about what they've stated their goals. Again, back to this kind of 4% less well off. But so overall then... the way that we can really affect climate change is with innovation, and then by prosperity. And that's, I guess, by helping these other nations kind of rise up to have enough money to where they'll want to do the switchover. Explain
yeah.
that.
Yeah, and you know, even just within the U.S., so back in Europe in 2003, we had a big heat wave. A lot of especially old people died in Paris and France. Basically because they were stuck in their apartments, they didn't have enough water, they didn't have air conditioning, and you know, that was terrible. You know, maybe up to about 15,000 people died just in Paris. And so people will say, we should do something about climate change in order to make sure that future generations of old people don't die in Paris, France. I get that point. But, you know, again, if you actually want to make sure that they don't die, maybe you should get them air conditioning. You should make sure that they have cheap power, that they have information about these things. There are a lot of other things that would be incredibly more effective. If you do climate policy, at best, you'll make sure that they will still suffer hotter and hotter temperatures, but they will die slightly less, much more. Instead of making sure that they get air conditioning and actually stop dying. And of course, that was what the French government did, because you know, most people are not stupid. They realize you need to get air conditioning in old people's homes and so on. And so next time, in I think it was 2016, when there was another heat wave, despite it was hotter than 2003, almost nobody died because we're a smart species. Right. So the simple point again comes down to saying, do you want to do something that's ineffective, incredibly expensive, and don't help the future people, or do you actually just want to be smart? The right answer is smart.
Of course you want to be smart. And that's the part that bothers me. And so we'll kind of maybe wrap it up with kind of this last kind of thought. But that's the part that bothers me is, unfortunately, I'm afraid that what we're seeing by our whatever leaders, our politicians, is not smart. And they're seeming to double down on policies that unfortunately are just driving us right off the cliff. And especially in Europe. I mean, you guys are in some parts of –
deep trouble.
In some serious problems. I mean, not enough natural gas, not enough fertilizer, not enough food, not enough heat. I mean, Germany has about enough natural gas on reserves to get through about 30% of their needs for this winter. I mean, that's a big problem. It's a drastic reduction in quality of life at a minimum, if not fatal in some cases. But they're only doubling down on these policies as opposed to going, well, we tried it and look what the problems is, so let's kind of reverse course. You know, in the UK, you know, I guess they're saying, hey, well, we'll at least offset some of this. But I mean, we got Germany's deindustrializing. That's a big problem. So the question I ask is then, I know you're at kind of the forefront of this. You speak about this. You're talking to people. You're one of the most influential people in the world on this subject. It seems that they're making not smart decisions and they're doubling down and not reversing course. Is that what you see? And is there hope? I mean, are they going to go, okay, this doesn't work. Let's switch. What is it going to take for them to get off of these positions that are just driving people into a dark, cold world?
Well, Mark, I wish I had the answer to that. That's, you know, that's the argument that I keep trying to get people to understand. So as you know, if you believe strongly enough in any political, you know, sort of statement, you can consistently for a very long time keep sort of explaining away the facts as you see them. So, you know, most people over here will say, oh, it's just because of Putin. And that's not incorrect. That Putin certainly has part, you know, Putin's war in Ukraine has part of, as part of the reason. And they will also say, ah, but if we'd had lots and lots of renewables, we wouldn't have had this problem, which sounds beguilingly true, but it's not, right? Because the real problem with renewables is not that they're expensive. It is that you don't have any when the sun is not shining and the wind is not blowing. And so fundamentally, you can't have an economy without baseload power, and we don't. And we've increasingly said goodbye to coal, goodbye to much of the fossil fuel that underpin renewables. And this is part of the reason why we're seeing this big problem. And we're doing it for the rest of the world as well. You know, a lot of the poor world now is not allowed to invest in anything but green energy. So we're basically forcing this choice on others. I don't think that we're going to see an easy sort of off-ramp for this, because a lot of people and a lot of organizations have put in a lot of their prestige in saying this is the world's biggest problem and we're going to solve it with solar and wind. But on the other hand, you know, what typically happens is a technology come by and it's just obviously cheaper, obviously better, and everybody realizes, oh, okay, we'll just do that instead. Imagine if you get cheaper, you know, nuclear by 2030. It'll basically eradicate most of the stuff that we build up with solar and wind. I think we'll just simply change leaders, and you know, the old leaders will be somewhat discredited. And yes, we'll have wasted a lot of money. All I'm trying to hope with these kinds of arguments is to try to make us, you know, waste slightly less money. I'm not very hopeful that we'll stop wasting money, but hopefully we can be slightly smarter. And of course, also in the U.S. and elsewhere, you know, please learn from our mistakes and don't make them. But I think if you look at most of the rest of the world, it's not like China is saying, ooh, we want lots of that renewables. They are doing some renewable. Some of it is probably smart. Some of it is to make it look good in the rest of the world so they don't get embargoed. Likewise in India. And some of it, again, is smart. But they're not going down this route. They're mostly just fossil fuel-based societies, as we were up till a few short decades ago.
Yeah, unfortunately, sometimes, you know, before you make serious change, you have to feel serious pain. And, you know, if you're an addict or something like that, sometimes you have to hit the rock bottom. Hopefully we don't go that far. Seeing Belgium turn off their nuclear reactor, something that we know works, that we know is safe, that works good, supplies 10% of our energy in an energy crisis, and we're going to shut it off willingly. It doesn't give me a bunch of confidence.
That's just insane. I mean, so you can have a lot of conversation about nuclear, whether it's, you know, when you build new nuclear, it's actually pretty expensive because they have to live up to an enormous amount of security and safety regulations that are not all smart, but, you know, it's very, very hard to get rid of them. But once you have a nuclear reactor, you paid the biggest cost. Running it costs almost nothing. Then you have to pay to decommission it, but you've already committed to that. So the reality is, once it's running, it's some of the cheapest energy on the planet. And again, so Germany should never have decommissioned it. Fortunately, California is now at least giving Diablo Canyon a couple of years. But you should let it run as long as you can. It's the cheapest way to get great electricity. It runs 24/7 and with no CO2. How is that not just a win-win-win? Again, talking about new nuclear power plants is a very different game. But if you have them, you should not shut them off before you absolutely have.
Talking about innovation, you know, we've had nuclear. We used to have ships that went by sails, and then they burned fuel like coal, right? And then they went to other types of fuel. And now, of course, our carriers and so forth run on nuclear today in the United States, right? Our military, our Navy, our submarines run on nuclear, and our submarines have been running on nuclear for over 60 years. A couple of little pellets in there. They run for 60 years. They never need fuel, and there's never been a single accident ever. Imagine like you buy a brand new car. An EV, a battery is not a power source, right? It just stores power. So the nuclear is a power source. Imagine a brand new car with just like a thumbnail size, a bit of nuclear in there, and the thing runs for 10 years and never needs fuel again. And so those types of innovations that maybe we.
I am gonna challenge that a little bit. I'm very confident that a Navy with lots and lots of billions in backup and lots of staff can maintain a nuclear power reactor. I'm not sure I would want to trust 90 million American drivers. I think we can all think of a couple of them that should never have something that has nuclear inside of them.
We're a long way off. I was just saying, to your point of innovation, imagine a fourth, a fifth generation, right? I mean, it gets easier, it gets cheaper, it gets safer, things like that. And so it just highlights some of the potential that we have if we could harness it and develop it even better. Yeah. Certainly not there today, for sure. But Bjorn, great conversation. I appreciate it. The book, everyone should go get it if you care about climate, as you should. It's a book of hope. It's a false alarm, but I like it. I mean, the world's changing. Like, no one's trying to debate that. It's at what extent and what is the risk? And I believe everyone needs to understand the cost benefit analysis of both, because you don't just get one without the other. So anyway, Bjorn, anything you want to point to other than your book? We're going to make sure to link that down below. We'll link your website down below. Anything else you want to draw attention to?
If you're so inclined, follow me on Twitter. That's where a lot of the, sort of very newish kind of arguments. But, we try to get out broadly. So hopefully you'll read some of my commentary in your daily newspaper. I try to write in Wall Street Journal and many other places around the world.
All right.
So, it was great to talk to you, Mark, as well.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit nfl.com/schedule-release to learn more.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man, and being a country megastar while also having 7 kids, you know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality. potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.